Now we turn to software for networked embedded systems, in particular the deeply embedded systems that are designed into wireless sensor network nodes. And we're going to give a basic introduction here and try to highlight the difference between writing software for embedded systems and for traditional interactive systems. We start with programming languages. And for many decades, deeply embedded systems were programmed primarily in assembly language. And this was to get the maximum capability out of the minimum amount of memory space. But now the tools for C have improved so that you can get pretty much the same efficiency out of C that you could with assembly language, but the programming is much easier to do in the first place and much, much easier to maintain the software once it's written and debugged. Now, that C has been so successful is possibly a bit of a surprise. It was designed in the late 60s and early 70s for systems programming, but its success is based on the fact that it's quite close to the hardware. In other words, you can do, for example, bit operations efficiently, but it's not too close in the sense that assembly language is too close. Now, many other high-level languages have been tried, but haven't had a big impact in the marketplace yet. And the reason people keep working on other higher-level languages is that you want better programmer efficiency, less bugs. The C language was not designed for interaction with the physical world like we need in embedded systems. So we have to come up with a combination of software and hardware to control and manage the peripherals on an MCU. Now this is accomplished by using direct access. We directly write to the control and data registers of the peripheral. What this means is that every bit of these control registers can turn on or turn off some capability or represent part of a value for a parameter that's needed to set the peripheral up. Obviously, this is quite tedious for the programmer. You have to understand every aspect of the peripheral. However, it leads to very lean code and very fast code. It's not very portable, though. In fact, it may not even be portable from device to device within an MCU family. There has been recent development of what we call library access. And a library of software is basically a compiled set of functions that a programmer can access. So in this case, instead of direct access, we make a function call, and so the library software takes care of the low-level details of which bits to program with what values. So that makes it a little bit easier for the programmer, but it does invoke overhead. And this is because every time you want to access a peripheral control register, you basically do a function call. And so this means that there is overhead in terms of processor cycles. The advantage to this approach is that it can be a little bit more portable, at least across members of the same microcontroller family. One of the most important aspects of embedded systems is interfacing with the physical world. And they have to deal with what we call asynchronous events, events that you can't predict when will happen. And the fact that you don't know when they will happen is part of what makes them interesting. A good example would be a sensor network placed along a critical section of railroad track that could detect an accidental release of a toxic gas. The toxic plume would be detected by a transducer that would be interfaced to the MCU via some analog electronics and perhaps an analog to digital converter. So the question is, how does the system become aware of a release? Well, a simple thing to do is to just periodically check. You would go out and turn on the analog to digital converter, check the value, and compare it with a threshold. And this could be done, say, every 5 seconds. And this is called polling, where the program that you write explicitly checks periodically whether a signal has changed. There is a more clever approach that requires additional specialized hardware and specialized software, and the approach is called interrupts. The basic idea is this. What if you had a special piece of hardware, a latch, that would trigger when the event occurred? Then that could have a direct connection to the CPU that would change the flow of execution. Instead of moving to the next instruction, the flow of execution would go to a little piece of software called an interrupt handler. And it could be as simple as setting a flag or doing a few calculations. And it is invoked as soon as possible. By this, I mean as soon as the current instruction completes execution. So there is a small delay. However, this delay can be very, very small compared to the delay that you would incur in polling, where maybe you would check every 5 seconds. Now, the interrupt handler is also called an interrupt service routine, or ISR. And again, it is a special piece of software. It requires special treatment by the compiler and the linker so that it can be invoked by this change in a hardware condition. Let's look at interrupts in more detail. Here we show graphically the path of execution through instructions in the memory. So each box here represents an instruction. And what we're showing here in the red is that sometime during the execution of this instruction here, we receive an interrupt. So a hardware latch is triggered, and that means instead of advancing to this next green instruction, the flow of execution is changed, and we invoke the interrupt service routine, or ISR. And then when the ISR completes, we go back to the green instruction, the following instruction. So there are a couple issues that come into play here. The first is that because an interrupt can happen anywhere, we have to write our code in such a way that it can be interrupted to run this additional code. So we have to somehow protect or save state. The most basic thing about state that needs to be saved is the program counter. Once we reach the end of the ISR, unless we've saved the address of this green instruction, we don't know where to return to. So at the most basic level, we have to save somewhere on a stack the address of this next instruction. The next thing that I want to mention is that because the interrupt can happen at any time, some of your data needs to be protected. And it needs to be protected from optimization by an aggressive compiler. And for that, in the C language, we use the volatile type qualifier. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. But what you need to know about this is that volatile says don't assume that the value of a variable will not change when you compile the code, because the interrupt service routine can run at any point in time. It might actually change that variable. In conclusion, interrupts are a little bit tricky. They require additional hardware and additional software, but they do allow for asynchronous interruption of the flow of execution. That brings up the question, what happens if an interrupt interrupts a currently executing interrupt service routine? And this can happen. You might have two transducers hooked to your embedded system or your sensor, maybe detecting two different kinds of toxic gases. And what if during the execution of the ISR for one, the other triggers? It can cause a big problem. And this is why new chips that have come out in the last few years support what are called nested interrupts. So you can literally have interrupts interrupting ISRs. Let's review very quickly the pros and cons of polling and interrupts. First, polling is very simple. You just simply check the value of an input periodically. But because of that, it can waste time and energy. Because if you're looking for an event that you can't predict, you may spend a lot of time looking for something when it hasn't happened yet. Polling is quite easy to debug because it is very simple in concept, but it does not scale well. What I mean by that is if you have a lot of inputs, then it gets complicated to pull them all at a frequency that each needs. Now we turn to interrupts. As we mentioned, they require special hardware. And this is hardware that basically sends a digital signal to the CPU to change the flow of execution. It turns out, once you know how, they're relatively easy to code, but they can lead to hard-to-find bugs. And the reason for that is that they can occur asynchronously. Unlike polling, where in your code you actually decide when it is you're going to check that input. Interrupts, however, are quite an elegant solution for a very typical kind of thing in embedded systems, and that is handling rare events. A good example would be an accident that releases toxic fumes. You could spend years polling a transducer when you could be saving energy. This is where interrupts turn out to be very, very useful. And the interrupt style of programming is used in the programming models for some MCUs. And we will actually see that in the experiments associated with this course, when we look at the MSP430, where interrupts are used to change the sleep or activity mode of the MCU. Embedded systems can get complex, and perhaps the most obvious example would be the operating system for a smartphone, because it must interact with a person and it must interact with the network or the Wi-Fi or whatever is out there in the physical world. In order to manage this complexity, we use operating systems. And you're, of course, familiar with desktop operating systems. But the key idea of an operating system It allows the management and allocation of resources. And these resources can include disk space, memory space, and perhaps most importantly, execution time on the processor. So we have allocation of resources, and this is done via a scheduler. And this, of course, means that time is allocated for different tasks on different hardware resources, and that includes the CPU, something called direct memory access, as well as, very importantly, in embedded systems, peripherals. There's a little bit more to operating systems, though. In addition to the management of resources, it also provides what we call mediated abstracted interfaces to those resources. The best example would be a file system. There is a huge amount of low-level and mid-level code that represents storage space as a system of files. And so when you make calls to the operating system to do manipulation of a file, for example, creation, input, writing to a file, and closing the file, all those details can be taken care of by the operating system. And this is true for both peripherals and input-output. Let's step back and take a look at the software design hierarchy for embedded systems. The foundation is, of course, the hardware that you're writing the code for. And as I mentioned earlier, in the past, a lot of embedded systems were written using assembly language. And the interface between the assembly language layer and the hardware was an assembler to turn it into machine code, a linker to link together different modules, and a loader to actually install it on the hardware. And as I mentioned, we also have libraries as a possibility. So for example, you might have a library to do 16-bit computations on an 8-bit microcontroller. Moving up the hierarchy, we see here the C language, which of course can be compiled into assembly language and for which we can also have a rich set of libraries. We also see here in the middle the operating system, which may or may not exist. Many deeply embedded systems do not have a full operating system. They may simply have something called something like an event loop, which we'll talk about later. Now, the operating system, to provide those abstracted and mediated interface, has to provide a way for programs, application programs, to do their jobs. And that is using an application program interface or an API. And so the operating system exposes the resources to an application program through the API. So you can see there is a hierarchy here going from higher levels to lower levels in an embedded system. Software is written to manage the activities of the system. And I mentioned event loop. That is the simplest one. And it basically means we have periodic execution of a set of tasks. These are simple and can be handwritten and invoke very little overhead in terms of software. At the opposite extreme, or what we call a preemptive operating system. And this is where the operating system has enough capability to preemptively interrupt one task and start another. And there are many out there, but probably the most popular preemptive operating system in embedded systems is Linux. A little bit simpler are cooperative operating systems. And these are a little bit different because they are event-driven. The difference is that one task has to give up control back to the operating system. The operating system cannot just interrupt a task. This makes writing the operating system easier, but it makes the system a little bit more fragile. And on the desktop side, a very typical cooperative OS that was replaced a few years ago was Apple's OS 9. So we move in terms of complexity from preemptive all the way down to the event loop. In between cooperative operating systems and event loops are what we call a time-triggered executive. So here we have periodic task execution, and it explicitly slots time into chunks or intervals, and we have a scheduler that runs so that tasks don't necessarily have to be run every time, in other words, according to a fixed periodic schedule, but there is some flexibility. But the key here in a time-triggered executive is that you have what's called a system tick, or sometimes just a sys tick, that drives the evolution of the system forward. So as we look at the possibility, we go from simple here to complex here. The cost of that is additional overhead, and that means you need additional program memory. You may need to run your system at a higher clock speed in order to get the responsiveness that you need. So there's always a trade-off here in what approach you take to managing the operations or activities of the embedded system. I want to conclude this segment on software with a look forward. And we talked about how C had become the lingua franca of embedded systems programming, but that doesn't mean it's where we'll be in 5 or 10 years. And it's because even C programs are complicated. Of course, they're simpler than assembly language programs and easier to maintain, but they still aren't good enough. It takes a long time to prototype a working system. One of the major reasons is that there is nothing in the C language that addresses the evolution of time and the occurrence of events. This is all tacked on to the language by the use of hardware such as timers and interaction with that hardware via a register. So it becomes specific to the MCU architecture instead of built into the language. So looking forward, we really need innovations in software design processes. And we need to understand better co-design with the hardware and looking at something that I call energy awareness. Now, we talked about time already, but wouldn't it be nice also if in writing your software you had tools that would help you understand what the energy consumption was of the device as a function of time? If you had that, that would allow you to minimize energy consumption and develop very energy efficient embedded systems.